In the lava fields inland of the Kona coast, it is 2 hours into the Bud Light Ironman Triathlon. The heat shimmers on the Queen K, and a pack of the best triathletes in the business chase this man, Wolfgang Dietrich. Dietrich's lead shrinks with each mile. He is now just 2 minutes, 20 seconds ahead of the chase pack. But this is the traditional pattern of the Ironman. The top swimmers seem to evaporate on the Queen K like drops of water on a skillet. Just over a mile behind Dietrich, Scott, and in an ABC van, Mike Adamley.
In the 1980s, Dave Scott has been the undisputed king of the Kona Coast. He seems to flourish in the lava fields while others wilt. Why is he such a force? Well, it's his keen sense of his own capabilities and the capabilities of his competition. He seems to have an uncanny sense when to pick up the pace or when to throttle down and conserve his own energy. But at the age of 35, does Scott have another peak performance left in his magnificently conditioned body?
That was Dave Scott, six-time Hawaii Ironman world champion on the ABC Wide World of Sports. And this is episode 12 of the Swim Smooth podcast. Hello, Adam. It's Paul here calling you from sunny Perth in Western Australia. Paul Newsome from Swim Smooth. Just in case you can't remember my name, Adam, how are you doing this morning?
We've never met before, have we? Who are you? Good, thank you. Thanks for mentioning the sun. It's cloudy and cold here. I've actually got snow on the grounds.
Really?
Just been out for a walk with a dog, crunching through the snow. Beautiful. Beautiful experience. I know you miss that sort of thing in Australia.
I do.
But I'm flying out to join you next week. I'm flying out on Wednesday, so I'm trying not to be too, gloating around my wife and everyone here. But very much looking forward to the trip. We've got we're kicking off some coach education, aren't we, in Perth, training the next batch of coaches.
The next batch of coaches. We've got four coaches coming over next week, starting on the 11th. We actually kickstart on Monday, the 11th of February, and we work all the way through to Saturday, the 23rd, which is interesting enough. That's the day of the Rottnest Channel Swim. Now, this, if you haven't heard about this event before, it's a 20-kilometer swim from Perth, or from actually really from Cottesloe Beach across to Thompson's Bay on Rottnest Island. 20 kilometres or just over 12 and a half miles for those of you thinking in imperial measures. And it's a great challenge and a great channel crossing. We have around about 3,500 people do this event, Adam, and you can do it either as a solo swimmer, a duo swimmer, or indeed as a team swimmer. So that's actually going to be our last day with the coaches, and we're hoping they're going to get a little bit involved with that. Unfortunately, I've had to pull out myself. I've got this stupid moon boot on, as I mentioned in the last show. I just decided I was doing a duo with Paul Blackbeard, and Paul's in his early 60s, but you wouldn't know it, Adam. He can still swim a 420, I think, for 400 freestyle, one of the fastest master swimmers on the planet, originally from South Africa. He's been over here for quite a bit of time. And originally, believe it or not, he used to work for Tetra Pak as the managing director in the UK. And my dad is a graphic designer and actually had a huge account with Tetra Pak over there in the UK. So somewhere in the past there, Adam, Paul Blackbeard, who I was supposed to be doing the swim with, and my dad would have crossed paths and probably spent a bit of time together. So there you go, small world, hey. But on to the coaches though. We have Mandy from Iowa City in Illinois. She's coming over to join us.
Iowa
City in Iowa. What did I say?
The clue is in the name. Not you said Illinois.
Did I say Illinois? Did I? Oh, sorry, my mistake.
That's all right. Your American geography. You're working on it. And Pam from Orange County. Yeah,
Pam's been meaning to come over two or three times now, but it just hasn't worked out. So we're quite excited to get Pam Nichol over here working and training with us. We've then got Chris Bagg. Chris actually still races at a very high level in 70.3 Ironman distance events. I think he still does a bit of Olympic distance racing there as well. So he's in Portland in Oregon and does actually a lot of work at the Nike World HQ. So when we mentioned we're going over there on the 5th to the 7th of April for our next three-day coach education course, we've got Chris to thank for that, for setting that up. And then we've got Tony. Tony's actually actually all the way over in Essex. That's a female Tony. Tony spelled T-O-N-I.
My neck of the woods. In fact, we used to live quite close together. So we actually, Tony and I know a lot of, you know, we know the same local athletes and everything. So it'd be interesting talking with her through some of that background and experience. Some classic swim types I can remember from 20 years ago. And I know that Tony knows those guys. So it's going to be interesting. Yeah,
definitely. Definitely. So yeah, got a little bit of history there, same stomping grounds, et cetera. So yeah, we're looking forward to getting the coaches over. Mm. And we just mentioned there that we might try and get them on one of the podcasts, have a little bit of an interview with them, maybe actually down there on pool deck and see how they're going through, see how they're working through everything. And it's going to be a great 2 weeks. We're going to really put them through the paces. Yep. We'll be up every single morning at 4:30 a.m. for a 5:15 arrival at the pool, and then 5:30 a.m. session. And over here in Perth, we have 12 squad sessions per week, which cater for pure technique, technique endurance. We do obviously the infamous Red Mist endurance sessions as well, CSS development, and our new Saturday Stoic session. So the coaches will get to be on pool deck with us for all those squad sessions per week, 12 of them, working with a range of different athletes, a range of different speeds. We see around about 450 athletes over the course of the week. So the coaches will get to see a range of different abilities, personalities, learning styles, those type of things. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, concurrent to that, we'll be running our one-to-one video analysis sessions. So that's where we get down and dirty, look at analyzing the strokes and making sure the coaches really understand what it is that we're doing, and more importantly, the processes behind that. So we've got Emma Brunning as well coming over. Emma's one of our coaches based over in the Lake District. She is our coach education mentor, to give her full title. So Emma helps us train up the coaches once they've been over here in Perth and make sure they go through all their assessments correctly. So yeah, it's going to be great to have Emma on board. She's been posting some wonderful pictures on Facebook of climbing places like Scarfell Pike up in the Lake District there, beautiful sunny skies, snow, or thick snow on the ground. And like I say, I think it's 38 again today. It just, you know, you might be thinking, what's this guy complaining about? You know, wow, 38, I'd love that. But you know, when you're right in the sunshine and stuff, and in the blazing heat from 5:30 a.m. till around about 2 p.m., which is what I was down there today, it does take a bit of a toll on the body. So the coach is going to have to stay very much hydrated. We'll probably get them on some precision hydration and making sure they're keeping nicely hydrated there on the pool deck. And, you know, get some umbrellas. I remember last time, Adam, you had to take a big old run down to Bunnings, didn't you, to go and grab some umbrellas for everybody. And I think 2 years ago, that was actually genuinely for the rain, but this time it's going to be for the heat. It's going to be to keep the heat off them and keep them cool on the pool deck. So yeah, what are you excited about the 2 weeks, Adam?
Yeah, working with those guys. I mean, just developing their skills and their coaching. They're all very talented. We know a lot about their backgrounds. Obviously, we've met them on the 3-day course and got to know them, and we've selected them from the pack. So yeah, just working with them, developing them. Just from a personal level, I'm going to catch up with all of my old friends in Perth. As you know, I've lived out there for about 3 years, so I've got lots of friends in the area. So it's a busy trip for me. I fly in for 2.5 weeks, 2 weeks working on my course, and I get the odd day or two to try to catch up with about 30 friends. So keeps me on my toes. And then I fly back home, and the wife, you know, has a massive job list for me, all the things I haven't done while I'm away. So no, but it's going to be fantastic. Can't wait to get off the plane and touch down. I'm doing the direct flight, 17 hours, Paul, from Heathrow to Perth. First time I've ever done it.
Yes, I'm quite excited about this. You're the first one who I know who's going to be doing that. So I'm going to be quite interested in your experience. Apparently they've got it down to about 15 and a half hours, depending on the wind direction.
Sorry, 15? Right.
Yeah, okay. I think it's still billed as 17 hours, but 15 and a half is some of the records. I think it's even been as low. I'm not sure. You'll have to verify this, but I think it's even been under 15 with like some crazy jet streams or something that they got on. So yeah, I'll be interested to see how your legs pull up after that, Adam, for being on the plane that long. But it would be nice to sort of get here and get straight into it. And yeah, I think I've got some jobs around the house for you here, mate, because you'll be staying with me, of course. And I'll surely put you to pace with some gardening or something in the backyard or something like that to keep you on your toes, mate.
Can't wait. All right.
All right.
All right. So who have we got on the show today,
Paul?
Well,
exciting. 6-time Hawaii Ironman world champion Dave Scott, totally prolific in the sport, obviously, and now in his coaching capacity. Another athlete who's still based over or resides in Boulder, Colorado. We had Simon Lessing on the show last week. He's also in Boulder, Colorado. Dave's in Boulder, Colorado. Dave was telling us about how wonderful the weather is there and how it's how they managed to escape the sudden deep freeze that you guys in the US are experiencing at the moment. So yeah, it's going to be great to chat with him. We first met Dave in Boulder in 2013. We were passing through, weren't we, Adam? We had a bromance as we drove across America from the East Coast to the West Coast, and we stopped in at Boulder, spent some time with Dave, training with his squad, etc., and then caught up with him. It was probably only 6 or 7 months later, wasn't it, at the London Triathlon Show 2014, where, of course, we both do a little bit of work with Hoob Design Wetsuits, us in the design and manufacturing of certain key features within Hoob Design Wetsuits, and Dave more so in the apparel line. He's got his own line, the Dave Scott line, signature line, etc. So yeah, it's great to have him on the show and get down and dirty with the detail. And I think what comes across in this interview more than anything is obviously Dave's tenacity. We talk a little bit about his views on training and coaching, those type of things. But Dave, if you've ever done any research into Dave, you can find him on Dave Scott Inc. .com. He is very passionate about dietary requirements of athletes and some of the things that he's learned. And you know, he's the first guy to say that he experiments a lot and has experimented a lot over the years to bring him to this point in where his beliefs currently are. And you know, he says it better than anyone. You know, learn from what I do, but also learn from my mistakes as well. And he gets down and dirty with those mistakes as well today. So yeah, shall we roll the tape, Adam?
Massively, yeah. Let's hit the go button.
Let's hit it.
Dave Scott won his first Ironman in the infancy of this event a decade ago. And he has been known as the man ever since. In a sense, anyone that wins this race merely borrows his title for a while. It should be noted that at age 35, Dave Scott has shattered his own previous Ironman record by over 18 minutes. And with this stunning performance, Scott has given Mark Allen something only he could give.
Okay, Dave Scott, it's awesome to have you on the show here, mate. Thank you for joining us this morning. What time is it over there in Boulder at the moment?
Well, it's still dark outside, Paul and Adam, so it's early in the morning, but pleasure being on your show.
Yeah, that's great. I heard you've got a bit of a deep freeze, they're calling it there in Central America, aren't they, at the moment? Is that right?
Well, we avoid that part of the country. Actually, here it's going to be glorious. We still swim outside year round here in Boulder, and we had a cool day the other day. It was about -6 centigrade, and that was kind of chilly. But today it's going to be about 13 degrees, and when it's 13 here, it's about 20 in your neck of the woods. Wow. So you know, we're at altitude, so when the sun's out, it's quite warm, and we all relish, you know, swimming outdoors even when it's pretty darn frigid. People aren't hanging out on the pool deck, but you know, they get in and go. And so no, that's the rest of the world in the U.S. is wicked cold, so I'm glad it over there.
No, absolutely. You can certainly see why so many people gravitate towards Boulder and the surrounding areas, can't you, for the training mecca that it is. And when we visited you over there in, I think it was actually July 2013 was when we caught up with you, Dave, over there in Boulder. It was an amazing place. And I'll never forget, we went into a supermarket when we first arrived there in Boulder. And, you have these preconceptions about what this wonderful place is going to be like. And I'd never been into one of those Whole Foods stores before. And everyone says, oh, you got to go and check out these Whole Foods stores, blah, blah, blah. Great for getting your dietary needs and stuff like that. I remember going down this one aisle, and this entire aisle was dedicated to various types of mineral water. Some of it was black, some of it was orange, some of it was red. And I was like, oh my God, wow, this place really is a healthy place to be and stuff. So yeah, that's one of my vivid memories of Boulder, Colorado. But there we go. Now, Dave, you've just celebrated your 65th birthday, is that correct?
Well, I wish it was my 61st. You kind of had a little faux pas there, Paul, and I'd accept that. Younger age. Yeah, 65 before we got on. I still can't get over it. I just, you know, I remember my folks when they were 65, and I thought, wow, they're wickedly old. And in the States, you can get we have a terrible healthcare system, but you can get a Medicare card, and it's kind of a, you know, passing of the ages when you actually have this card. So I have this card, and it doesn't make me feel good.
No, I bet. But you still look like you're in fighting fit shape as usual. And a couple of my friends over here in Perth, they know that I was going to be chatting with you. And they said, the first thing they said is, you know, I said, do you want to ask Dave Scott anything? And they said, how does he look so good at 65 years of age? And how does he look after himself? So, I mean, so what does a week in the life of Dave Scott look like these days in terms of like fitness and training? What do you get up to these days?
Well, it's obviously been curtailed quite a bit. I'm having a run issue. I was just talking about your foot issue. I'm not in a boot, but I've had a kind of a lower heel, just on my calcaneus, my talus muscle. So I'm unable to run for the last 2 months. And I'm real tight in my hip flexor, which is part of the problem. It's always pulled on that backside. So running's at a zero. I still strength train 3 days a week. And I try to do mobility and stretching in combination with that. And I actually do that 5 days a week. I do a little bit at home every night when I just sit down and finish eating on the floor if I'm by myself and get on the floor. I swim 5 days a week if I can. And a lot of them are shorter. I do a lot of higher intensity interval training because guys at my age have this you know, muscle wasting and sarcopenia, which is pretty common. And so I've always been an adamant spokesperson on, you know, when you get old, don't lose that muscle mass. And so when I do a lot of strength training, I take it to kind of a deep, heavy fatigue. And there's also some good metabolic changes with that as well. So I'm kind of manic about that. And still get on my bike. I love the bike. I have a road bike or a tri bike. I work with Scott bikes, and those bikes are a lot faster than what I raced on, even at my age. So I get in 3 times a week at least, or 4 if I can when I'm home. So that's kind of it. I, you know, it's typically anywhere between about 10 to 20 if I feel so inclined. I mentioned to you, Paul and Adam, that I have this heart arrhythmia, which is really common with endurance athletes, and the single biggest threat is, you know, going long all the time. We don't need to dwell on this. So I don't go long time wise. I don't do that. And you know, I feel decent. I, you know, my diet's changed quite a bit over the years. My advice has changed.
Yeah, but I'd be quite keen to tap into some of that actually, Dave, to sort of see how things have evolved. Because obviously, you know, we're talking 1980 is the first Hawaii Ironman that you won, of course. And, you know, I'm sure things have sort of changed in both the sport, obviously, which we'll dig into, and also your approach to it as well. But I just want to start off actually with one factoid there. You mentioned there about the Scott bikes and how they've changed and how much faster they are. Obviously, Kona just gone, 2018 there was a record breaking year, the fastest anyone's ever seen before. And I remember listening to a podcast with Lance Armstrong, and he was talking about, you know, some of these times will never get beaten, maybe for 30 years or if ever. And I was just looking back at the great year of 1989, the so-called Iron War between yourself and Mark Allen there. And had you finished this year in that record-breaking conditions in the same time that you did in 1989, it would have still finished you in ninth position, just a handful of seconds ahead of Cameron Wirth, who now holds the bike record around Hawaii. I mean, you know, that's 30 years ago, and you're riding a bike which would be significantly less effective back those days. You know, I mean, you must just be like looking at these results and seeing some of this equipment and thinking, man, you know, if I had that back 30 years ago, you know, you imagine the sort of things that you'd be able to do there, Dave. Does that go through your head, or is that just sort of me romanticizing a little bit about that?
Well, you're very eloquent. You know, of course it comes up. It comes up. I was in Kona this year, as I am in every year during the Ironman race, and it was a historic weather day, a weather day that had, it was a cool day. It had favorable winds going out and back. And as everyone knows, the cycling times all the way through the age groups were just out of this world. The one element that is different with the exception of Patrick Lange, the champion, is that the athletes can certainly run faster than I ever could imagine in the shorter distances. And they have run faster in other Ironman races, but collectively the marathon times, which you alluded to Mark and my time back in 89 and a few of the other ones, they are slower. And I, even when I was working with Crowe and looking at his running skills and at the 70.3 and certainly Olympic distance racing, he was a quick lad, and he still is. But he never ran to his potential. And even when he went 8:03, he had stopped and cramped. And you know, on paper, he should have been 2:35 off the bike in Kona. Jan Frodeno, Gomez, Patrick Longa, you know, a whole slew of them that are great, 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 brilliant runners, but they're not doing it in Kona. So I kind of agree with Lance. It was a historic weather day. I think the, you know, the bike equipment and the bikes themselves are just out of this world. And as I mentioned, my Scott bikes are fast. They're real fast. I'm in my office right now, and I have only a few things that I've kept over the years. I've given everything away, but I have my 1980 Ironman bike that hangs sort of above me in the entryway. And people come in, they look at that, and just said, you actually didn't race on that thing. Yeah. I said, yes. And it's really, and it's a natural state. It's like a, it's like a heavy, dense brick. But even going through the 80s, the bikes were, you know, pretty rudimentary and heavy. So, you know, it's hard to say, oh, coulda, coulda, woulda. But I'd like to see the top men and women run faster. They're still not running fast. And I think it's a combination of possibly training issues that they're doing. One of them that I alluded to, which is probably doing some strength training year round. They're not showing their talents on the run. But that day was you know, an amazing day. And will it stand for 30 years? It could. I think the one thing that we might see is, boy, can we get a weather day that's close to that? And can those guys run 10 minutes faster? Then we're going to have a phenomenal day.
One of my my training buddies who we had, who was the very first podcast guest, actually, Dan Plews, he won the age group there in Kona and went 8:24. It was just a phenomenal result. And that's a guy who I used to train with 25 years ago. He's now a physiologist over in New Zealand for the New Zealand rowing team over there. And, you know, he was just talking about how epically good the day was and how good conditions were. And, you know, he ran a 2:53, if I remember correctly, or 2:50 maybe off the bike. And I think it was like the top, you know, it was the fifth fastest run split. So, you know, you often talk, Dave, about your one of your fondest memories being 1994, coming second in your comeback year at the age of 40, and then again in 96, running 2:45 off the bike at the age of 42 years. So I can definitely sympathise with where you feel the sport should be going on the run there, for sure. If you were speaking to somebody, obviously Patrick Langer looked absolutely phenomenal this year, and I remember going out for a 25K run when he started his 42K run, and we're thinking, oh, we'll go out for this run, we'll go into a steady run, go out there, come back, and we'll have loads of time to catch him coming across the finishing line. And we came back, you know, he's run 17 kilometers further off the back of the bike and the swim, and we literally had time to quickly grab a cup of tea, and he was like coming across the finish line. It was like, wow, that's pretty good going. And he did look very impressive, obviously, on the run there. Is it, so you mentioned there the strength training, is there anything else that you sort of think, you know, might help these guys, or is it do you reckon they may be overcommitting on the bike perhaps, or is there anything there that you think, or
I can speculate a lot, and I don't coach them, and I you know, anecdotally I know, and I know a lot of most of the top guys and have chatted with them, but I don't really know what their training program is. The only thing I can surmise is that I think a lot of them are seasonal with their strength training. They do it kind of in their off season and they let it go, and I think this is a real mistake, because the mantra in the sport still is, you know, if I have time, my aerobic physiology is going to be enhanced by going longer. And if you're going longer, and as you become more fit, and those long bike rides and longer runs or bricks that you're doing become faster and faster, the resiliency of the athlete is amazing. And without citing names, I coached a handful of folks out of Perth and Penrith, and they had this crazy weekend, and I would say this to their face. They're riding long, and then on Sunday they do a bike run brick. The problem with doing this is that, yes, the body can handle it, but are we getting adaptive changes in muscle physiology? Is the blood volume going up, capillary density, and mitochondrial function? And one of the things, the energy organelle is mitochondria. It actually worsens with long distance training. Sure. And it looks, you know, if you look at a 10-year-old's mitochondria, not to be too technical, but it's the energy organelle that provides ATP, whether you're anaerobic or aerobic. And a 10-year-old's looks like a beautiful sphere. And someone who's done a lot of long distance training looks like they've taken a hammer to it. In other words, the functionality of it and the efficiency of this one energy organelle, thousands and thousands, is actually reduced with this long stuff. Getting to your question, Paul and Adam, I think a lot of athletes have a tendency as they get close to their big races, Ironman races, they want to go longer and faster. And really, they need to save that or be very selective about putting those in. I'm not averse to going long, but you can't do it week to week to week to week. And this is the single biggest precursor to having heart-related issues. Going long seems to be the common thread with cyclists, triathletes, myself. And we can look back historically and say, well, you went long or you ate this and you were pretty good. You won the Ironman X times or whatever. And I always look at it and say, you know, I did a lot of things right, but there sure were a lot of things wrong in the messaging.
Wow.
This is the thread. And when people start going longer, it's hard to maintain this same strength output. So where I see a lot of the best athletes performing well is early season. They come off their lighter training. They may be doing speed work, which they should be. And they're fresh. And so our seasons are obviously flip-flop, but after the sort of off season or build season or whatever you want to call it, they're having these amazing races, but it's very difficult to do it when it really counts at the end of the year. I mean, a few of them obviously percolate to the top. So I think strength training year-round is really key. I think maintain the mobility. We can talk about this more because I drone on a lot.
No, it's all good stuff actually, and it's very pertinent to where I'm at the moment. You know, I Richard Hobson, who used to coach me at Bath.
I know Richard, and I also know Dan Plews, who you just mentioned, because we're actually working together on S Fuel. So I'm actually have a conference call with Dan tomorrow. I'm going to ask him about his intake and his train and all that business. So, and I know Richard from way back when.
Yeah. So Richard had us on a really good strength training program at Bath University. And, when the national lottery program came in, some of that got lost a little bit. And I've often thought whether or not, I've often think one of my misgivings as an athlete is just not being functionally strong enough for a variety of things. So I've got this foot issue at the moment. Could it be related to to lacking a bit of strength and mobility and just all the stuff that goes with sitting at the desk a little bit too long every day and just not getting mobile enough. But if it's not too much of a personal question, Dave, when you were racing, and obviously won Hawaii six times, what was your sort of weight like during that period? And not that weight itself, absolute weight, is necessarily a true reflection on how somebody's built or anything like that, because obviously you were incredibly lean. But one of the things, looking back at some of the old races and footage, et cetera, that I've been looking at just recently, you just look very, very strong. You don't look the absolute skinny beanpole that we see with many of the ITU athletes, et cetera, but you do, and you always did look very, very strong. So if it's not too much of a personal question, did your weight fluctuate much? And do you see that as, where was that in that period of time?
Quit dancing around the question, Paul. You're too polite. I was kind of...
He's too British.
Just spit it out. My candor will kill you. During the early years, and a lot of people know this because I talked about it, we know that carbohydrates work. I was a carbohydrate machine. It didn't matter what type of carbohydrate. Carbohydrates as a whole are very inflammatory. And they affect your whole systemic engine. And I think ultimately they affected my heart. And there's lots of good studies in many, many areas about carbohydrate intake. I've shifted 360 degrees from way back when. I'll get to your question. So I think a lot of the earlier shots, I mean, I came from a swimming water polo background. I had more muscle mass on top. I was chubbier. How's that for a term? And a lot of people would say, gee, look, water retentive, Dave. And that's kind of going into the race. I would try to lean up a little bit before the race, watch my dietary intake so that I was a little bit lighter. But really, when I started shifting my diet to closer to what it is now, but really not the dynamic shift that I've had in the last 3 years, was in the early 90s. So in 94, if you look at pictures, and I don't want to bore you to death looking at Dave Scott footage, but I was much, much leaner in 94 than I was in the six races in the 80s. And I maintained that in 96. I know when you saw me in 03, I was leaner then. So really over the last 25 years since 94, I have been leaner and really in the recent years, which we can get into or not, I've been on a ketogenic diet, which is very low carb and high healthy fat and moderate protein. So quite the flip from where I was back then. I think a, yes. a lot of the athletes that we're looking at today, and I see this, you know, we all can carry muscle mass in different ways. And so we see a lot of lean athletes. That doesn't necessarily mean that they're weak. The leanness is a common thread with the best athletes, male and female. But one of the terms that we use here in Boulder, and people will come into this town, I'm sure you'd notice this. Oh, gee, all the athletes are lean. We say skinny fat. And a lot of the skinny fat athletes don't have any muscle mass. They've lost lean muscle mass. And, you know, the common claim is, gee, my same weight has been the same since I was in high school and I feel great. And we see this with men and women my age, same weight, but a huge loss in lean muscle mass. I think we're seeing this in athletes that are 25 or 30 years younger that are racing right now that are able to maintain, you know, great quality of racing and maybe a reasonable quality of life. I question that, but I think they are, they're not doing their strength training. So, you know, in a long winded answer, I was heavier during my earlier years. I was a lot leaner. I think that is really key. I think dietary issues are a big part of it and also maintain strength training.
Yeah, it's interesting what you say there about the carbohydrates and link to inflammatory responses, et cetera. We just had, literally today, we just launched our 11th episode of the podcast with a coach called Matt Currie, who spent a lot of time mentoring with Brett Sutton. And Matt's based over here in Sydney and spent a long time talking about how his diet has shifted very much in the same line as you've shifted yours. And I know Dan Plews is a big fan of that as well. So yeah, I'm sure on your conference call together tomorrow, you'll have a good old chinwag about diet because you definitely on the same page with each other. So just turning the clock right the way back then, your first race, Dave, that was the Turkey Triathlon, or what has now become known as the Turkey Triathlon, if I'm getting my facts right. Is that right?
Oh, I don't think it had a name. They didn't have the word triathlon wasn't even in the vernacular and in the dictionary. No. So it was, you know, it was just this event that was concocted by this crazy Marine who was immune to cold water and cold conditions. It was in San Francisco during our early winter season in November. The water temperature was, I think it was 12 degrees. The air temperature was the same and no wetsuits. So wow. There was no turkey trot or turkey triathlon. It was just go do this event and
survive.
Survive. There was no aid stations. There wasn't a transition area. You just put your bike on the ground and you'd go through these intersections blindly with cars zooming by. And the order was kind of flipped around. There was roughly a 15K. There was no real measurement. I think it was around 15K. And then the run was second. I wasn't even going to do the run because way back when I was having some knee issues and I just came in off the bike. I was just wearing my old tennies. And I was kind of looking at the guys going on. I said, gee, I was up there pretty high on the bike. And then I went over my car, opened up my car. And I'm not really sure why. To this day, I'm not really sure why I did this. But I had another pair of tennies. This is my transition. And I put those on. And I said, okay, I'm going to go after these guys. And
wow.
The run was, I'll say, around 7K. And then the end was this frigid swim in San Francisco Bay. No wetsuits. And I think there were three or four guys ahead of me. I don't even know. I caught one guy who was hanging on the chain of the anchor of the ship that was in the bay. And I think he had a whole body cramp. The guy was just frozen with pain and fear. And I kind of came up next to him and I said, it's a race. And I just said, how are you doing? And I didn't really listen for his response. I thought, well, someone's going to save him. So I went by him and I think the swim was around 1,200, 1,300 meters. So I ended up winning that, you know, silly event and everyone was hypothermic. And I said, oh, this is a great sport. I hope we can do more of these. And that was back in 76 when both you guys.
Wow.
You weren't.
Now, me and Adam, we both swum in San Francisco Bay there. We got invited down to the South End Rowing Club had a little dip down there. So we can definitely attest to how cold it is. Can you remember that swim, Adam?
I can. And it was in July, I think, wasn't it? So it was June. So hardly the coldest time of year either. So yeah, it was very cold.
Well, and that's exactly where the swim was. Aquatic Cove is right there by South End Rowing Club, but the seasons were different. The water temperature doesn't fluctuate a lot, but it is cooler in November, so you got a good taste of it.
My fondest memory there, Dave, is actually coming out of the water, freezing cold, and then jumping upstairs. And we've got the sauna, the indoor sauna that just looks out over San Francisco Bay and the Golden Gate Bridge. And you just sat there just warming yourself up. And it was an amazing experience, that was for sure. So jumping forward then, slightly then into like 1980, then when you did the first ever or your first ever Hawaii Ironman. I was just looking at this actually just a moment, because you mentioned there that triathlon wasn't even in the vernacular there at that point in time. Now, if you Google today, right now, today, if you Google the word triathlon now, Google returns 110 million results.
Wow. It's come around.
Exactly right. And, you know, I mean, obviously, Google in 1980, Google still hadn't been invented for another 18 years at that point. So, but like you said, it wasn't even in the vernacular. No one really knew what it was. So how did you prepare for that your very first Hawaii Ironman in 1980? What were you relying upon? What sort of information were you getting for that?
I was relying on ignorance. You know, we didn't know anything. I didn't have a mentor or a coach, never did through the years because, you know, I had a background in it. But, you know, to select from a squad, there wasn't a squad. There wasn't other athletes that were doing the sport. So I swam and played water polo in college, and I started running when I was in college. I didn't own a car until I was 25. So I just ridden an old clunky bike around, a Raleigh something or other. I, you know, tried this earlier event in 76. There was a couple swim run events that cropped up, 77-8. And in 78 was the first Ironman. I was over there in the 79 event because I had competed in the Waikiki Rough Water Swim, which was the original 2.4-mile swim, 3,900-meter swim. So I was aware of it. I was approached at the time, didn't know it. John Collins said, "Oh, you should do this." He singled me out because I won the swim. And he said, "You should come and do this Ironman race." And so the seed was planted in 79. There was an article in Sports Illustrated after the 79 event. And the first three events were held in our winter time, January and February. So I went over there in January 80. And I really didn't know how to train. I knew how to train very hard from the swim, like most swimmers do, and started applying that to running and cycling, but I had never ridden 180K, and I thought maybe it would be a good idea to run a marathon before this this event. Yeah. So I did a local one. I lived in Davis, Sacramento. It was about 30K away. I did a Sacramento marathon, and the fall of 79 and ran 2:45 with no shirt on and no food. And
did you really? Wow.
I thought, well, that's not that hard. Again, being very, very naive and ignorant. And then I thought, well, maybe I'll do a kind of a mock triathlon. So there was a 100-mile bike ride, kind of a bike tour. And I thought, well, I'm going to do this. So this was in Davis where I lived. And it was about a month prior to the race. And so I did a 100-mile ride. I got off. I'd mapped out a 20-mile run. And then I went over to the pool. I worked at the pool. So I opened it up and I swam 5K, which was kind of excessive. So I did this long day. And I thought, I felt great doing this. And I thought, okay, I'm ready for my Ironman debut. So I honestly, I didn't know. There happened to be an NC2A a champion, Division II. His name was Tom Bowie, and he was in his first race in 80. I, of course, knew about him. I never could beat him in the when we swam in college. And now I was 26 at the time. So we're same age, both a few years out of college. He had entered that first race. And, I remember seeing him. I thought, oh, man, he's an amazing swimmer. I seemed to do better in the open water. His stroke was like a chainsaw. It was really wickedly bad. Mine was equally bad. But I felt like, well, he looks really chubby, to use the same word I did earlier. And I got away on the swim there, and I never saw anyone for the rest of the day. So it was just kind of a time trial for me. And the first day I remember crossing the pseudo finish line, there was about 10 people at the end of the race.
Wow.
And actually, the footage is very funny. In the 1980 Ironman, it was covered by ABC Wild World of Sports, and they didn't know what they were doing. you would never know the final shot where I finally stopped running and I'm just walking, that I had crossed any kind of finish line that was designated as the finish line. And just, you know, there's a few people clapping like, wow, you did this thing. So I didn't answer your question. I didn't really know what to do. And I just trained hard and that was kind of it.
How many people these days, how many people do you think would be able to get through an Ironman with that same level of naivety? Not through, obviously, back in those days, you weren't naive because you meant to be naive. It just wasn't any information there for you. But if somebody, you know, if somebody came up to you now, you know, mid-20s and said to you, I'm going to do an Ironman next week. I've heard about this great event. I'm going to go and do this Ironman next week. I'm just going to do a 5K swim in the pool and a bit of a marathon at the weekend. What would be advice to them now, knowing how it felt on that particular event and how sore you maybe pulled up afterwards, Dave?
Tough question. I think one of the things, and obviously you're in the coaching industry, is that you see a lot of people that, you know, mentally are really challenged by the challenge. In other words, they all of a sudden sort of have this fear of failing, and it becomes pretty prevalent as they get closer to the event, and they can disregard all their training, the great days they've had and other races. Now we're within 2 weeks of the race, and they have this psychological black seed that's sort of planted. And I actually see this and hear this with a lot of the pros, and I'm asked this question like I have a crystal ball. Who can win? And I always kind of dissect this down to about three men and three women. They say, well, how about so-and-so? They won this race. And very callously and coarsely, I would say, I don't think they're mentally tough enough. So to winning Kona. Getting back to your question, when I went to that first race, I was blind to what may happen, but I went in there very optimistically. And I said, you know, I'm going to have the opportunity to run a marathon on the end. I felt good in my first marathon. I never had any doubt that I would be overly fatigued. And if I did, I'd slow down and get right back into it again. I've always had that outlook. I've always said this to other athletes. You kind of have to look at what you've done. You know, the fear of the unknown is what you're kind of alluding to, Paul. And there's a lot of unknowns. Yeah. And when you're blind, you don't know what's going to happen. But why weigh the scale a bit heavier on the negative side? And I've never done that. So I would tell the same athletes, gee, you're fit. You're going to have a great day. Make sure that you're doing this physical inventory when you're racing. You know, do these body checks. You know, how's your core doing? How your hips, your legs, your back, how's your breathing rate? And just stay calm and relaxed, and it will unfold. But I see a lot of athletes that have a tough spot, and I'm sure you've seen this with open water swims.
Yeah, definitely. I think, just prior to jumping on the call with you here, Dave, I managed to find a pretty cool video actually that you just recently released with Hoka. Do you pronounce it Hoka Oni Oni or 1-1? I've never been quite sure about that.
The first
Oni Oni
version.
Yeah. Oni Oni.
Yes.
Yeah. The fantastic shoes. I've been running them myself for about 3 or 4 years, and I'm sure you swear by them as well. And this video clip just been put up in September. I'm just going to play the snippet from it because it definitely digs into that sort of mental tenacity that you have and how to sort of deal with it. So just let me just run this one here. Here we go.
In 1996, when I came back, I had this quiet confidence and I felt like the game was back on. Time before the starting line in 1996, I was as nervous as I had ever been for any race. And I had this on the swim as well. I got caught in this bubble. And this bubble didn't allow me to get around. I didn't feel great. So I got out of the swim, not discouraged, but knowing that I didn't have a great swim. I got out on the bike and I said, here I go. And my legs just felt empty. And now I'm feeling sorry for myself. I should have stopped like everyone told me. And I reminded myself of all these negative notes. Bad thing, a real bad thing. It took me about 4 hours to finally get out of it. And I remember at mile 85, I said, I have an opportunity to run the marathon. And I know my running legs are going to be great. Now I had great legs because my mind said, do it. Someone said you were 26th place coming off the bike. I was able to catch the fifth guy at about mile 23. And all I needed was another 10 miles in the race. I always ask my athletes, never lose faith within themselves. Faith breeds the highest probability of success. That run was a life-fulfilling athletic accomplishment for me. Mentally, I pulled myself out of this dark, deep dungeon, and I said, I can still do it.
Wow, there we go. It's pretty epic stuff there, actually, Dave. And I'm getting a little tingle down my back just listening to that. I can't say I've done anything extraordinary today, but I did listen to that just before I went on my turbo train and my wind train. Just before I jumped on here, it was definitely inspiring me along and making me push along. I wasn't going to any major dark places, but I'm definitely going to dig into that one the next time I do. So, that's pretty epic stuff there. How do you, when you're on the sidelines watching some of your athletes racing, is there an opportunity? Are you able to sort of reach out to them? How do you get them to bring themselves around in the way that you did in 1996?
Very good question, Paul. I mean, that the race in 96, I kind of described it in that clip. And I've always felt that when we really look at training days, we have these ups and downs, these little glitches where you just feel wickedly bad and we don't dwell on it. You kind of look ahead and say, okay, I'm going to get myself out of it. And you go through this sort of mental mantra I keep using the word the seeds that allow you to forget the negativity of what has transpired. I saw this with fortunately I had the opportunity to coach Chrissy Wellington and a few of the other top ones advised Crowe through several years, and I could see this vein of confidence, but at the same time, and I'll use Chrissy for an example, she was so hard on herself, and that's what really ultimately made her multi-world champion. And I had to remind her, even after several sessions where she didn't perform well and she was below her standard, and I said, this is just one little glitch. And a lot of the athletes, amateur and world champions, have a very short memory on performance. They can look back about 6 or 7 days and forget all of that. So what's current? What's currently happening? We have these tables where we kind of flatten out, and psychologically we're not there, and physically our body's not responding. And the tendency is to really think about how badly you're doing at the moment. And I think one of the key things, and a very simplistic statement that I have shared with the athletes while I'm on the course watching them, and I have said this to them all the time. I mentioned this, this faith breeds the highest probability of success. The other line that I said is, do what you can do at the moment, and be very, very present. And in Chrissy's last very historic race in Kona, without going into all the details, 14 days before the race, she laid her bike down, Drew, my son, crashed on top of her. Chrissy's going to the hospital, unbeknownst to me. Drew breaks his race. It's his first Ironman. It becomes her last race, and she couldn't even walk. I mean, I carried her out with Tom Lowe, her husband now, and this was day 12 before the race. We carried her out of the gym. She had a reaction to all the road rash. She had infections. Wow. And she had already made her mindset, I'm going to be doing Kona. So it wasn't like, well, you're kind of beat up, by the way. you've got this Ironman race. You sure you want to do that? I never said that, ever. When I said, what do you think? And she said, I'm going to do this. I said, okay, that's what we're going to do. And we were a team. Wow. So I think overcoming some of those obstacles, being very present, like, what can I do right now in this race to turn this around? And you always have to enable yourself to allow that calmness to pervade you, but also this latitude of easiness in your mind that you have the capability to dig a little bit deeper, and you can pull yourself out of this abyss.
Very sage words there, Dave. And I think obviously a lot of that applies to many different things in life, of course. just being able to be present there and in the moment. I think it's certainly something which I've been guilty of not being great at it in races. But the times that I do, or the times that I have done, you know, the results definitely come from there. Yeah, good. Adam, have you ever been in some dark places when you've been racing, sir?
Oh, yeah, of course. And I think in my experience, well, it gets easier with experience. Would you say that's fair to say, Dave? Is you've had good races, bad races, you can see the bigger picture. I think the hardest time of all is when you're a relatively new athlete. And, you know, if you're coaching relatively new athletes and this is a brave new world for them, they're going out, putting themselves on the line, and it's hard, you know. But that's why you should train hard, because you experience those dark times in training too, and come race day it's all hopefully a lot easier. Would you say that's fair to say, Dave?
A little bit of a yes and a little bit of a no. I've seen some of better athletes, as they perform, the psychological barriers become greater, the expectations and the outside, whether it's the media, which is a huge part of it, and I know Chrissy and Craig have dealt with that. I did too. And if you've never really experienced the top, but you know that you can win the world championships, but you haven't done it, you feel a lot of internal pressure. And certainly on the outside, you know, people are saying you can win this. So, you know, I've seen other athletes, without citing their names, where they haven't really drawn out that final little bit of potential that they had, and allowed them to mentally extract their absolute highest moment when the table was set for them to do this. And I know I'm kind of dancing around this because I don't want to bring up this woman's name, but I saw this and I saw this in my eyes, in a tough sentence, this supreme failure, because the opportunity was right there in front of her. So yeah. I think part of the mental train is not just training hard, but also reminding yourself of key phrases or adjectives. You know, you're flowing, you feel powerful. Mm-hmm. You know, I tell people on the bike, take a look at your legs. You know, we all have these magnificent looking legs with muscle in them, and just talk to your legs and your body, and look at your hands and your wrists, and think about your breathing, the simple little things that you can do in a physical inventory. And that has a calming effect. And I think we have this sort of frenetic sort of attitude when we race, that I got to go, and that person's going hard. And I remember one year that Crowley was racing in Ironman, a year that he did not win, and he was in this kind of peloton that develops in the men's race. And I saw him in the race about 50K into the race, and he's 16th or 17th. And it's like an accordion. One person goes, the next one responds, and they're generating watts well above their VO2. And he was doing this, and he didn't do well in the race. I remember the next year I said, never get out of third. I said, stay in the top three. You're going to be in the same scenario. Be in the top three. Don't let that fourth guy go around you, because then you're not going to have these ups and downs. But I said it because I wanted to tell him that you have the mental tenacity to do this, and don't let this other guy go around you. They recognize you as a weapon, and that's a tough word. I don't usually use that word. But your arsenal is much bigger than theirs, and they recognize that you have the run ability. So if you're flirting with their discomfort on the bike, look out on the run, because you're going to blow them away. And that's what he did.
Yeah, it's some amazing performances out there to look back on. Is it who really excites you at the moment, Dave? Whether it be in Ironman distance, half Ironman distance, Olympic distance, is it male and female? You know, who are your key tips or picks, I should say, really, at this point in time? Is there anybody you really think, yeah, that guy, you know, he's doing good, or she's doing great? I really, really admire how they're doing.
It's a tough question. It's one that I've kind of avoided.
Fair enough, yeah.
Paul, I just, you know, I think sometimes it's a discredit to the athletes. I mean, obviously, everyone can look at the results, and you look at Daniela Ryf. I mean, she's just out of this world. But she has not run to her capability based on her 70.3 race in Kona. And last year, you know, an historic day for her. Could she run faster on the marathon? Yeah, I'd say yes. If I was coaching her, I'd say, let's get that run going. Is it because of the bike? Is it, you know, why? So, but she's remarkable, and she's amazingly resilient. Which is really incredible. You know, I look at, you've mentioned Cameron Worth. I mean, I met him a couple of years ago. We were doing an interview with Bob Babbitt, and I knew of him on paper, and you know, he's an animal on the bike. And but I'd like to see him run faster. He's had better runs, but he's run poorly in Kona. Why? I don't know. I think he still has a lot of potential in the sport. And then, you know, of course, the racehorses, Frodeno and Langa and Gomez, the Brownleys, if, you know, they step up. I mean, I really feel that the ITU athletes, both men and women, are going to be the next generation because they maintain that top end. And I said this to Craig when I saw him first race in Pacific Grove. I think he was 96 or 7, and I didn't know who he was. I knew him on paper, saw him win the race, and you know his history. Didn't make the Olympic team, and I thought, wow, he's talented. Stepped up to 70.3 and has obviously smashed everyone, and did the same thing in Ironman. And when I worked with him, I said, never lose that top end on your 70.3 or Ironman racing. If you know, it's basically if you do, you're going to be in trouble. I didn't say that, but I always feel that the top athletes that come from these shorter distances are going to be our best athletes.
Yeah, absolutely. I I'm quite fond of the Brownlee brothers myself. So to sort of see them, especially Alistair, jumping up to the longer distance stuff, and just sort of seeing what's capable, what's possible, it could be very exciting stuff, I'm sure. Switching gears slightly, then obviously we spoke there about 1980. You've then won again in 1982, 83, 84, 86, 87. What was life like for you during that period? Like, was it just, you know, I'm assuming it was just very, very full on, concentrated on the racing. You seem a little bit like how people used to talk about Lance peaking for the Tour de France and that being his goal race. Was the Ironman always the key thing for you every year? That was the big race that you were building up for. I'm assuming it was, but what was life like for you during that period of 80 to 1987?
Yes, it was. I mean, that race became the designated, you know, big race and world championship. That wasn't a title on it, but it really was the world championship. Everyone wanted to perform well in Hawaii at the Ironman race. And I became a marked guy. I was the honeybee. So I was the target, and it was a race that I kind of built my year up to. You know, I got to be on my game, and every race was different. There were a lot of races leading up, being the ones that I won that I, you know, deep down inside, my confidence wasn't very high. But as I get closer to the race, I said, okay, I can do it. Even within a week of the race, I said, gosh, I don't feel very good. I hope on race day I can pull this off. But wow. I mean, during that time, I, you know, contrary to what I think people think is, you know, you seem very focused. You're, you know, a training machine. You did it by yourself. Yes. But and I think a lot of this was actually attributed to the carbohydrates actually that I was eating. I had these massive ups and downs in training, but it also affected, you know, this gut brain connection. You know, I think my brain was dramatically affected by my intake. So I would have a great day, and then the next day, like Chrissy, I would beat myself up psychologically because I felt bad. I couldn't perform, and. Back then, it became this psychological mallet on my head that if I couldn't do it the way I wanted to do it, what was on my training schedule that I had written for myself and my plan, it was all or nothing. And it was a really psychologically destructive pattern that I was in for a number of years. I saw psychologists several times and trying to unravel this. And you know, if I had a 20K run and I had to shorten that run even to 15K, I wouldn't do it. And it was like an alcoholic, you know, it was all or nothing. So I'm very candid in my comments because I think it's helpful to look at this sort of elevated pedestal that we put world champions on, myself, and feeling like, oh boy, we just had this myopic view. We trained, we ate well, we were done at a psychologically ready. And I was not at all. I was a roller coaster. And I kind of got to the point where it was pretty destructive, I think, in my marriage at the time. My first child, Ryan, was born in 89. That was prior to the race in 89. That gave me a good distraction. And I had a couple solid races, Ironman Japan, and Mark and I raced in October. And I started turning it around a little bit because I had a little bit of a diversion, and that was a good thing for me. The diversion was children. I had a second one 15 months later. Drew was in the picture, and now I had these two little people running around, and it wasn't all about me. So I think, yes, to answer your question, I did focus on that. I think the other focus that people have said, well, you didn't do these other races, and you know, the history of the sport, I did other races, and in 89 I did a lot of Olympic distance races, and I did well in those Olympic distance races, and I felt that those were feeders to the Ironman race, and I actually came over and raced Mark on the Gold Coast in 89. And we had a close race. Mark had a historic run that year on a 30K run, and he caught me on the run. I think he ran 138 high off the bike, wow, which I think was one of the best runs all time in the sport. It was the Ironman was my ticket. That's what I wanted to really perform well at, and was able to kind of pull it off most of the year.
Yeah, definitely. That link that you mentioned there between, you know, obviously the psychology or the mood, as it were, and carbohydrate, etc., is very, very interesting indeed. And I think we'll get stuck into that in just a moment when we have a little chat with you about your diet and where your philosophy has sort of changed a little bit over the years and maybe where you're at presently on that. But it'd obviously be amiss to skip over the 1989. Race between yourself and Mark, what is known as the Iron War. Now, believe it or not, you mentioned there about the heart condition you're currently sort of working through there at the moment, Dave. One of my best friends over here in Perth, he's somebody who swims with me. He is actually a cardiac specialist over here. And I've got to say, I'm sure a lot of people claim this title, but Laurie Dembo is without a shadow of a doubt the world's biggest Dave Scott fan. And we met up on Monday morning to do a very quick chat, because he has a very, very, very fond memory about how that race panned out. Not just the result itself, but what it meant for sport. And I'd just like to play that very short clip for you just here with there. And it features just a little bit of commentary from the ABC team there as well. So here we go.
So, Laurie, we're here at Claremont Swimming Pool. We've just been chatting about the fact that we're going to be speaking with Dave Scott, the man. This Friday lunchtime, I think it is, Perth time. We're going to be having a chat about Dave's history and career. Now, I know you're a massive fan of Dave Scott. Tell us a little bit about, you've obviously sent me through some of these audio clips, these historical audio clips. Tell me what your recollection is of the 1989 Iron War between Dave Scott and Mark Allen.
Well, it's much more than just that one race, because for me, that moment, you know, my brother and I played a lot of sport growing up, and that moment encapsulates everything there is about sport. You know, it's brutal, and I remember how the commentary goes. You know, they're flicking between Dietrich and Scott and Alan, and it's never Alan and Scott. It's always Scott and Alan, certainly in my house. You know, and they're sort of saying, you know, like, you know, the hunted and the hunter. You know, 3 miles into the marathon, and then they flick to Dietrich, who's running along, looks all right. You know, and they flick back to Scott and Alan, who are just cruising, right? And they say, you know, and here's the line. They go, you know,
Wolfgang Dietrich has led this race for over 5 hours. Scott and Alan blow by him as if he never existed. Where there were three, there are now two. And Mark Allen, previously content behind Dave Scott, has pulled out abreast of him. The race this sport has waited for has begun.
That's the moment of true sport, right? It's brutal, and it's all about being in a certain zone, and they were there for another mission, and I love that about sport, and it raises a whole lot of questions for me as well.
Absolutely. I think, obviously, we had Simon Lessing on the show last week, and he talked very much along those same lines about the idea that when he was racing, he was at war. It wasn't about slapping his mate on the back and being friends with everybody. He was actually going to war against these people, and like you say there, Laurie, the brutality of that is quite interesting. So you also had one other question for Dave as well regarding the training. Obviously, the difference in the training that we know between Mark Allen and Dave Scott. Just share that with us, and I'll ask Dave now what he thinks about that with respect to his coaching these days as well.
Yeah, well, I guess the kind of the mantra these days is all about this sort of polarized training, a lot of slow stuff, a little bit of quick stuff, you know, and which is, from my understanding, a lot more like how Mark Allen trained, and my understanding at least of how Dave Scott trained was, you know, you train hard, every training session's a race, and then every now and again you kind of break down, you have these periods where you kind of into force training, a lot of mental angst that comes with it, but gee, when you race, you know what that feels like. And I wonder if, you know, Dave, you could talk a little about the difference between, you know, maybe how professionals train or versus the man on the street, how you can deal with injury, how you deal with training to win, and your thoughts about binary training versus training hard in most sessions.
Absolutely. I think think the binary training that Laurie's mentioned there, many people term it polarized training even. And when we had Dan Plews on the show for the first time, our very first episode, Dan was talking a lot about polarized training there as well. So, Dave, over to you. We want to know what you think about all of that.
Yeah, very good question. Very good question. Big question. To a fault, which I've alluded to, is that every session can't look the same, and you never take a swimmer in a pool and say, "Oh, we're going to do 2100s today, and we'll do it tomorrow and the next day, and I want you to get faster every day." I mean, the nonsense of a statement like that is in triathlon, there's a lot of variability, and certainly on the bike and the run, you add hills and gearing in and out of your saddle. You can kind of go kind of hard, and I use this terminology a lot, in a lot of sessions, and you can string them back to back to back to back, but it has a lot of damaging effects. I alluded to prior to this question that I had a lot of ups and downs, and I think in hindsight, some of those down periods, psychological ones, which manifested into a physical break because it was all or nothing. I had these breaks. I think that allowed me actually to come back up. If I was like a metronome and kept repeating the same type of pattern over and over and over and over again, I would see a lot of what I speculate that a lot of the athletes are doing today, where they don't have this variability in training. They're not doing any anaerobic work. They're not having segments where they're doing VO2 sessions, and I call them anaerobic endurance sets, which are the higher intensity interval pieces. Physiologically, the adaption from this is huge. So I think probably maybe what Mark was doing, I don't really know, back then, and he didn't do all of the sessions easy or just a little pieces hard. I know that that's false.
Okay. Interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. Let's not categorize him. And I think you need to get Mark on your show and he'll probably clarify all this.
Yeah.
And I didn't do all of mine hard, but I certainly did the ones when I was really focused about going fast in Kona. I'm going to get on my bike. And again, this was to a fault. I would get on my bike and I would go flat out in the first 1K if I didn't have a stoplight or a stop sign. And I did a lot where I just sort of locked in. So mentally on those sessions, yeah, I was a deranged nut. And I just, okay, keep pushing yourself. No one's next to me. How hard can I go? Well, I seem to have the willpower to do that. I'm not really sure that's something noble about
it. Could you find any training partners to sort of hang with you on those sessions, or was it very much training solo?
Really, the only training partner I had was a very close friend, still to date. He's the one, his name is Mike. He's a physician. And he said, "Dave, you ought to do this Ironman." That was 1979. He said, "Oh, you do this. You're suited for this race. It's real long. It's hard. You can win this race." Mike would come over to Davis, California, where I lived, and we would play these crazy games. Quite often we would go out together. I would go, this on the bike, and same thing in the pool. I would try to chase him. And we finished many, many sessions where I didn't see him for an hour and a half. And I said, "He's right up the road. I know I can get him. I can get him." And he'd finish 3 minutes ahead of me. It was just this neurotic behavior that we seemed to manifest in each other. But he was my training partner. It was kind of a silent one. He wasn't at my level. I'd catch Mike periodically, and it just became this crazy game. But I didn't have a training team, it really, in any discipline. And the same thing on the swim. I did a lot of sessions by myself and had to mentally say, okay, go a little bit faster. This one's going to be at X pace or whatever it is. And I seemingly had the ability to do that. But again, I can look back and say, in advising athletes now, that and I use this big term, the metabolic return, aging wise is huge, but performance wise, if you're doing these higher intensity interval pieces, you get a magical return, particularly on just on the simplicity. These fast twitch 2A fibers, intermediate faster fibers, are really stimulated nicely, and they reduce glucose intake. They elevate fat burning, which people use a lot. They elevate this kind of protein called a cytokine, which is very favorable. And the bad ones go up. The myokines are the ones that are the favorable ones. The cytokines are the ones that cause this inflammation. Long training, carbohydrates, which a lot of people do, are the ones that cause a lot of the damaging effects. So
Yeah, right. Okay. So when did you start to switch the focus then to the what is now obviously the ketogenic diet, as you mentioned there? And how long did it sort of take you to come to that realization that maybe something out there was better than what you had been doing?
I didn't know about the ketogenic diet back in the 90s, but I knew that the amount of carbohydrates I was eating, so that was the very first thing, was really damaging. It was damaging psychologically and physically. Wow. It was really impairing my performance. And again, I had mentioned this, Paul and Adam, that in 93, prior to the 94 race, when I had turned 40, I said, you know, I want to get fit. What do I need to do? And, you kind of go down your checklist. And one of the huge things was starting to change my diet. And, I think a lot of athletes, I kind of went through a period where I was trying a vegetarian diet, a lacto-vegetarian diet, lacto-ovo-vegetarian diet, a macrobiotic diet. And a lot of people have been very healthy and successful on that. But I think one of the things that people are missing is possibly the proper protein, also omega-3s. And so I started eating cold water fish. That was a really good thing to do, and really got rid of the really low level carbohydrates, even though we can metabolize them through the same pathway. So I was eating like buckets of juice, and I got rid of all that. I got rid of rice cakes, which are this manufactured, right? It doesn't even look like rice. It's like eating, something off your wall or, it's just wickedly bad labeled food. So I started getting rid of that. But the ketogenic diet, I started shifting quite dramatically. So there's a term called low carb, high fat, LCHF. And this LCHF diet can be keto or not. And you can get some great metabolic changes, but you're not producing these liver-based fat bodies called ketones. So people that go on a low carb, and that really means around 20 to 25% of your total calories and carbohydrates. So even people that say, oh, I've reduced my carbohydrates, and they might be at 50%, most people do not get changes performance-wise or metabolically. You really have to start limiting the grams of carbohydrate that you're taking in. And to be in ketosis, you've got to be down at 5 to 10%. It's not absence of carbohydrates. So a lot of people think, oh, God, that's too difficult. It's not difficult. And I was just out in Hawaii. I have four camps at Four Seasons, and I do a talk on diet, and I don't throw this down their throat, but I give a big chart of what I call Dave's superfoods. And it's really a silly title, but it really shows the amount and types of foods that you can have, including healthy carbohydrates, which an athlete should have on a ketogenic diet or on a low carb, high fat. So it's not zero carbohydrates. And I think where a lot of the misinformation is that statement. Because it's really net carbs. You're taking out the fiber. So you can look at the cruciferous vegetables. There's good fruits that you can take in. But you really want to try to minimize that so you get these huge metabolic changes and you produce this chemical messenger called a myokine, which is really helpful among other things. You get rid of your visceral fat. That's a huge thing. So people that have an abdominal fat, one of the key things when you get rid of carbohydrates, the carbohydrates are digested differently, and the fruit juices, the fructose, the fruit sugar, has to be digested through your liver. The other sugars that are eventually broken down to glucose can go to your other organs, your heart, and your kidney. But fructose is very specific and very particular. So if you don't break that down, the end result is you start laying down visceral fat. And so people that have this little meat roll around their midsection, and quite often it's not even seen because it's internal, that is an inflammatory marker. You have it around your organs, and that's the dangerous type of fat that people develop. And it's attributed directly to carbohydrates, not healthy fat. So that's a real misnomer and unfortunately an injustice in a lot of the information that not only the Aussies here, but here in the States where it really came from, but around the world, the developing countries, that saturated fat is bad for us, and that's false. And a calorie is a calorie, and that is false as well. There's a whole bunch of them, but anyway, I don't even know what you asked me, Paul, Adam, but
that's really, really, really interesting stuff. Like I say, it's a very similar conversation to what we had with Dan and also with Matt Khoury just recently. And it's, you know, whenever I've tried reducing my carbohydrate intake and stuff, I've definitely felt significantly better. We did, like you said, me and my wife went in Australia, there at least there's a book called The No Sugar Diet, and it was literally get rid of absolutely everything, and it worked for maybe about 2 or 3 weeks, and then just felt absolutely terrible after that. So I totally understand what you're saying there about it not being totally zero, but working down to actually get the percentages down quite significantly. And yeah, I've always felt a lot better on that. And I just even watching Dan Plews on some of his stuff on Strava, when he puts them out, he sort of, you know, mentions that he's gone out and done a 120k bike ride on literally a gram or two of carbohydrate. Yeah, if even that.
He was saying when he set the age reward record in the marathon at Kona, he only took two gels. That was his only energy input for 26 miles of running off the bike, which is what?
Yeah,
200 calories, something like that. So his fat burning must have been phenomenal.
Well, you can get high fat oxidation or fat burning on a low carb, high fat. I mean, this is a discussion. Dan and I both work for S Fuels, a new product that's coming out. And so we're having this discussion tomorrow afternoon here, which is interesting because his name has come up a lot. I have a very specific question about him in gravitating to simple carbohydrates when he races. I don't know if he's in nutritional ketosis. I know that he's a prescriber of low carb, high fat. I don't agree with him in taking in simple carbohydrates on the bike or the run, even though it was, Adam, as you said, it was a small amount of only 200 calories, and he's able to do this.
Yeah, and I'm not sure what was in that gel. Maybe it was something a little bit special. I'm not quite sure. That was just sort of the quote that he gave out. So I hope I haven't misrepresented him there. But you talked about like losing belly fat, etc. What sort of difference will it make when you're training? What sort of markers would you notice when you change your diet like that?
Well, Paul, you just mentioned you tried it for a couple of weeks, and there's an adaptive time when you change this. One of the first things that people will notice, and you can drop weight real quick, is that a low carb or high fat causes diuresis, which is just a flushing of water. And so you end up flushing your system out because you're not retaining water from the carbohydrate intake. So you have to increase your sodium intake. That's huge. And typically magnesium and also potassium. You can get some good sources with potassium, but those need to be taken as a supplement. And the sodium intake, just to give people a range, typically you have to take anywhere between 2 to 5 grams as a supplement, independent of what you may be taking in food sources. So that helps retain a little bit of water on this low carb or ketogenic diet. And when you're shifting from really depending upon glucose to fat, you have this sort of sluggish feeling because your organs, your skeletal muscles and organ, that's used to this. But the interesting thing is that you are actually, you'll become more efficient when you start oxidizing fats, and you can get oxidation levels on fat at 1.5 to 2 times what a person who's dependent upon just fueling themselves with sugar all the time. So you can start shifting this over by, you know, weaning yourself first from the carbohydrates that you're taking. And then in training, try not to go out the door and suck down a gel or fluid replacement drink right before your ride or your run. Depending on what you're eating, let's say that you've made this shift, your body prefers the carbohydrates. So you negate the ability, particularly in this transitionary phase. So stay away from it. See if you can go out with a minimal amount of intake and see how your body responds. And I get this question all the time. I've had it for 30 years. I had GI distress on the Ironman race, and I go through their calories that they've taken. And,
oh, yeah.
You know, the single biggest thing is too much too soon, and they're able to kind of get through the bike, and then all heck breaks loose on the run.
So. I can put my hand up to that, Dave. I did my – one and only 2004 Ironman over here in Western Australia. I didn't actually finish, and I had a dietitian help me with my nutrition strategy. Had a great swim, came out in the top 10 there. settled in on the bike, and I was so paranoid about whether or not be taking enough calories that I had almost like an Excel spreadsheet taped to the top tube of my of my bike, and making sure I'm ticking it all off as I was going along. And anyway, as I was going along, I started to think to myself, I started to question all the training I'd done, even though it'd all been going fine. I thought, I better just take a little bit more. I'll just take a little bit more. Yeah. And in retrospect, I was at least 100 to even potentially 120 grams of carb per hour. And I remember getting to 90 Ks on the bike thinking, why? I feel like I'm bonking here. Why am I bonking? So of course, in my head, I'm thinking, right, I'll take in some more sugar. So taking some more sugar, started to get the distended, bloated feeling. And then no word of a lie, Dave, I jumped off my bike and sat down by a tree and fell asleep. I fell asleep during an Ironman.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, God, the medics came and grabbed me off the side of the road and said, mate, you're going nowhere. And that was my one and only Ironman. I want to put pay to that. You know, I want to still want to do an Ironman. But, yeah, getting it wrong like that. And, you know, you see people on the pool deck as well. Like, people turn up to my pool deck and they'll have, like, for an hour and a half session, they'll have three gels on their pool deck waiting for them. It's like, what are you doing?
Yeah.
What's going on here? Just crazy, but there we go. That's really insightful stuff, is all of that. And I think on your website, davescottinc.com, there's quite a bit of information, isn't there, about your advice on dietary and stuff. So I think we'll try and put that in the show notes and bring people's attention to that information that you got up there. And maybe if you have anything else, let me know, and I can certainly put that in there as well. So I appreciate you've got a busy schedule, and I've just got a couple other questions, and hopefully won't try and keep you too long here, mate, if that's okay.
Sure.
You're a brand ambassador for many different sports, and you've worked with different products and trying to improve that product development, etc. Two such companies which we're very familiar with ourselves are Hoob Design with Dean Jackson there over in the UK in Derby, and also Finis as well. And I hadn't really appreciated just how strongly you feel about the excellence of the Finis products. And I was just looking at a few of some of your YouTube videos, which are all absolutely excellent. And one of the first ones that I came across is something we do over here in Perth all the time, and everyone feels like we're completely crazy, is to actually swim with one paddle on one hand, as opposed to actually swimming with both paddles on. Right. Can you share a little bit for the listeners about why you do that as well? Because I as soon as I saw it, I was like, that's great. Fantastic. I felt like, it's definitely in sync with what we're doing here.
Yeah, I have used this for quite a while, Paul, and sometimes I put one paddle on the left hand and one fin on the right foot. So we'll go opposites, and even to mix it up even more, I'll put their paddle, whether it's a Finis paddle and their mate's paddle, so they have two different size paddles and two different manufacturers as well. So they got a right and a left. So and the reason is not just, you know, bloody confuse them the whole time, but to heighten their kind of kinesthetic sense and their awareness and the pressure on the paddle. And, you know, I like a single paddle. We do it all the time in the sessions, probably for the same reasons you do. A lot of the triathletes are really very, very, very tight through their whole chain. And typically their rotator cuff, their shoulder, the you know, those muscles that come in and around your humerus bone, you know, we think of our lats and our serratus, but the whole complex, your pecs attached to your humerus, and they really impair the ability to extend that arm out in front as shoulder flexion as you're reaching out in front on your entry. And so putting a single paddle on gives them a little more pressure on the hand, allows them to linger longer on the front end without dropping their elbow, which is a big problem.
Yep.
And so in trying to get the timing of it to allow their hand not to dive down too deep because their shoulder's real tight. And a lot of them, their thoracic spine, they don't have a rotation or extension, and their hips actually will pull because their hip flexors on the anterior side and posterior side. Those big three are inherently tight. Shoulders, thoracic, spine, and hips are tight. And then, coaches are saying, go distance per stroke. And I said, don't do that. You're going to sink out of sight, and you're going to cause deacceleration. So single paddle's a great exercise for them to, I use the two words, linger longer in the front without feeling as though you're having to extend your arm necessarily to 180 degrees. If you can, you have better mobility. Great. If not, stop it at 170 and keep your wrist joint line just slightly lower than your elbow. I tell people that the elbow's got an eyeball on it, and that eyeball wants to look out towards the side of the pool, not down.
This is one of the best. Can you delve into that because it's a fantastic illustration of how to get the catch setting up properly. And I hope you don't mind me plagiarizing that with some of my athletes here, because it is one of the ways which I remember you telling it to me when I was over there in Boulder with you in 2013. It struck a chord. It's fantastic. Tell us exactly what you mean there by the eyeball and the elbow.
Well, we're not plagiarizing, Paul. We're teaching good swimming.
Absolutely.
to a lot of people that are just bloody tight, you know, and you think, swim like Ian Thorpe or Michael Phelps. I say, well, they can't. Sorry. You got to use your imagination. And I just imagine that right on the point of your elbow, the prominent bone on your elbow, you've got an eyeball, and that eyeball on your entry, when your hand goes into the water, you want just a little bit of air space when that hand goes in. So it's a plane coming into the runway. It's not a nosedive descent. So as your hand goes in below the surface, you still have a little air space at your elbow joint, and that eyeball on your elbow is looking out towards the side. So if the coach, Paul, you're on the side, they can see that little eyeball on their elbow pointed out towards the side. The difference is if they put their hand in, all of a sudden they try to get distance per stroke and they extend their hand out. Typically, the hand will evert to the outside. It'll dance to the, if they're right-handers, the right hand will dance to the right side. We don't want that. And it'll cause the elbow to drop. So the elbow now, the eyeball is looking at the bottom of the pool, and that's a bad position. So
definitely.
I have people stop even with a single paddle or both paddles or no paddle, and I have them stop at sometimes 150 degree elbow extension. So if you put your hand in and just stop your stroke short, that eyeball and the elbow is now out to the side, and that will enable them to get a high elbow set on the front end. A lot of the athletes, as you know, that are very hypermobile, and we see it more in women, have really good wrist flexion and a high elbow set. Most of the triathletes, because they're tight for all the reasons I mentioned, I just teach them to how to apply a little bit of pressure initially on a little bit on the tip of the paddle, keep the eyeball and the elbow looking to the outside, and then they are able to get that forearm vertical position a little bit better, or at least
brilliant
theory.
Yeah, I was working with an athlete today, actually. She just finished top 10 at the Australian Open Water Swimming Championships. Really, really nice swimmer. Awesome. And but just extending just a little bit too much, like you say, there, everting the arm out and dropping the elbow, as it were. And we just did a little bit of work, exactly like you mentioned there, about just trying to get into that catch a little bit earlier. Mm-hmm. Initially, she fought the sensation because she thought, I feel like I'm shortening up my stroke. And everything she'd ever heard was all about trying to make the stroke longer, take fewer strokes to be more efficient, etc. So I popped up a bit of a side-by-side comparison with Mac Horton, the current Olympic champion 400 freestyle, and Gregorio Paltrinieri, who's one of his best mates, who's the current Olympic champion in the 1500. And the interesting thing, when you watch them swim in the 1500 side-by-side, Paltrinieri is taking 12 more strokes per 50 meters, which, you know, would have been scoffed at in the old days about people saying, oh, it can't be efficient if he's taking 12 more strokes.
Right.
But, you know, he's the guy with the Olympic gold medal around his neck. Yeah. So go figure. You know?
Yeah.
So something's obviously working. And as soon as we made that change with her stroke, you know, she's one of those people who just, you look at it and she goes, she looks absolutely amazing even before we did any adjustments. But we just spent a little bit of time just tuning up that eversion of that hand out to the side, making sure she wasn't putting the brakes on. And one of the things I did with her right at the end, Dave, was we used a parachute just to indicate how much continuity and continuity in the propulsion that she has. So she wasn't actually having those periods of dead spots where she's decelerating between strokes. And she could sort of feel that the changes she was making was giving her that nice sort of consistency there, which was great. Now, with Hoob wetsuits, you've obviously done quite a bit of work with those guys. You've even got your own line. How's that been working with such a company as with Dean Jackson there?
Well, as you know, Dean, he's a character in himself, but but he's very open and willing to look at the latest technology. And I think that's always kind of been the forefront of how Hoob and the Dave Scott line has evolved with Hoob. How do we move forward? It's a higher price point, but we better prove the merit of it. So, you know, we look at fabrication, you know, whether we're looking at breathability of it, whether it has an SPF factor, what's the zipper length, what's the neck look like, you know, do we want longer sleeves for sun protection, aerodynamics, and the whole aerodynamic movement is a huge one, which is going to be coming even more. So he's got a good scientific pool as well, in not just saying, you know, we like a pretty color on the sleeve. That's secondary. So I like the science part of this whole sport, and fabrication and technology and function of it is really kind of key in the whole Hoop DS line.
Absolutely. And I dare say no one's seen that evolution better than you, Dave, across the years and the decades over the years and bringing that to it. You mentioned Scott Bikes. Am I being ignorant here? That's not you, is it?
No, but I wish it was, it? Darn it.
No. Is it, what is the connection there, though? Because obviously you
share a name.
Sharing the name, of course, sort of thing. But even like the Scott Tri-Bars and stuff from back in the day, am I being ignorant there? Can you tell us a little bit about what is that connection there, Dave?
If I was an astute businessman way back in the day, I would have been sitting in my rocking chair at 65. The first four Ironman wins, I got a T-shirt. There wasn't money then, so it was lean back then. I'd fly myself over there. But the Scott bars, I saw one of the first aero bars. This was in early 87. A guy named Boone Lennon, who worked for Scott at the time, and he was a downhill ski racer. And they said, you know, the most aerodynamic position is this tucked position going downhill. And then he said, you know, we're going to try to put this on a bicycle. And he actually carved the first set out of wood. And I remember he put it on at the time, and I just thought, oh, my gosh, this is the most unwieldy thing. I feel like I'm going to crash every time I turn.
Yeah.
And then later that year, you know, the first iteration came out. And, of course, you know, they were crazy in these big cow horn looking things. So I didn't have a connection with Scott in the last few years. I do, you know, everyone knows, you know, their bikes are in the tour. They're a lot of the top triathletes are riding their bike, road bikes and TT bikes. So, you know, just the technology from way back then on the bars now to the different bike geometry and the type of tubing that they use and the components are pretty fancy stuff.
So. Yeah, definitely. So it was just purely a coincidence then back in the day with the name concept. It wasn't like an ode to yourself with the racing and stuff, or
that's correct. Just coincidental. Yeah, just coincidence. So I still take claim to fame with them. So now I actually have a relationship with them, and you know, I could obviously speak proudly, but I don't have the heritage with them.
No, right. Interesting. Right. So just to sum up then, just to finish off here, obviously, your son Drew, you mentioned you've got two boys there, but your son Drew has been producing some pretty good results as an Ironman athlete himself. I would imagine that's quite a big shadow to live up to. But one of the things we're just doing a little bit of my background research, I thought was really quite interesting, because you mentioned that you've coached Drew up until a point, but then realized that it might be better to have somebody else coach him. Can you tell us a little bit about that? Because my son, Dave, he's 9 years of age. He's, you know, doing pretty well with his swimming over here. I dare say he's got a much better physique than I have for swimming. He's already, you know, the tallest kid in the class and all these sort of things, which I never was. But one of the things I've been really careful about is, you know, he knows what I do for a living, and all his friends know what I do for a living. But I've been very careful about actually coaching him directly for fear of actually driving any sort of awkwardness between us. So what I do personally is I coach his school swimming team on a voluntary basis. So he's in there with 30 or 40 of other his mates and stuff, and it doesn't feel like it's directly not all the focus is on him. So when I was reading that about yourself with your relationship with Drew, I thought, wow, that's really quite insightful. So for the listeners then who may be listening in, they've maybe got children, maybe they've been triathlon or endurance sports for a long time, they're passionate about the sport, they want to get their kids into the sport, but they're concerned like I am, and like it sounds like you are as well, about not pushing too hard. What would be your advice there then, Dave?
Well, just for the record, Drew is a firefighter now. He's no longer a triathlete. He's 28. He was extremely talented. I think pretty remarkable on the bike, and still holds some of the Strava records with all the pro cyclists here up one of our canyons. But he was kind of riddled with a lot of injuries. He had a couple stress fractures in his foot. He went over to do Ironman South Africa, and he fell off his bike a couple days before the race, and he fractured his spine. And he just had a series of always rehabbing, and some were kind of serious, like the last one. Kind of got to the point where he just said, I can't do this anymore. And emotionally, it just tangled his mind too much. And he would say the same thing. So he's fighting all the fires that we have in the States, and likes the rugged, rugged work of that. And so this will be the second season that he'll be doing that. And just for the record, I also have a daughter, Kara, who's...
I beg your pardon. Sorry, Dave.
Yeah, well, that's okay. A lot of people don't know that I have three children. I'll talk about her first. She was a brilliant runner. I mean, I just love seeing her in soccer. She was the fastest girl on the team. And then one day, I think she just got tired of her three jock men that were in her family, her dad and her two brothers. And she said, I'm not running ever again. And that's kind of been what she's done over the last 7 years. So I kind of failed on that department, is, you know, vicariously living through her athletic talents. She's a good dancer. Thank goodness she has other skills. She advises me, about relationships. I'm not very good at that. coming back to the kids and your question, Paul, I did coach Drew for a while, and both my older son, Ryan and Drew could have been, and had the opportunity, I think, to be very good triathletes. They came from Nordic ski background and they did a lot of different sports. My older son, Ryan's kind of a jack of all trades. He's got great balance. He looks like an ox. He's real, real strong. Drew is a willowy triathlete looking guy. And I coached him, and I think it worked fairly well, but it got to the point where it seemed a little bit combative. And there was a challenge of, is this the right thing for me? I'm not performing as well. I'm his dad, and I'm his psychologist. I'm his physical trainer. And we kind of reached the point in his early, really 5 years of triathlon that, you know, I'm not his coach. I'm his father. Right. And it was the right decision. He recognized it. And I said, Drew, you need to get someone else. It's a real fine line. I think we all want as parents, you know, it's a simple statement. We want the best for our kids, but I think there's a lot of hand holding. There's a lot of massage, and I was never that way. There's a lot of guiding. And I think, you know, if I could do it again, would I change a few things? Yes and no. My style is, I can nurture athletes, not just my children, but there's a fine point where they've got to fail on their own. And I think when I see failure, that does potentially breed the opportunity for success. And I think there's too many parents, and I see this all the time. They're always giving their kids things. And I saw this with my daughter. They'd play a soccer game, and afterwards, you know, I'm thinking, gee, the kids played terrible. They let down. They lost by a goal. Deep down inside, the competitive nature of Dave Scott is like, wow, what the heck? And they're giving, you know, they're, let's go out to lunch, or let's give them a backpack, let's give them a trophy. And I said, why? For what? Let's get them back out on the soccer field to practice their skills. So, you know, I come from a hard school, and I've always felt that, because I think a lot of the kids have this sort of entitlement, and I think it's massaged the wrong way with the parents. And I get along with kids really well. I can walk into a kids group or a coaching squad or whatever, and I get kids, but I don't get parents. And I think a lot of the parents have to step back a little bit and let their kids live and let them fail. Let them really fail, because they're going to be better people.
No, absolutely. I'm hearing you loud and clear. It's like the whole mantra, everyone's a winner these days, you know, everyone competes. And the school where my kids go to, it's actually quite a small school. So in some of the age groups and some of the races, you know, there'll only be three people, and, you know, everyone gets the award sort of thing. And, you know, it's good to obviously support kids and make them feel positive and healthy doing the sport that they're doing and stuff. But like you say, you know, I think there is a danger of over pampering to that. And I think we see that across the board in not just obviously swimming and triathlon, but in a range of different sports, like you say, with soccer and those sort of things. So I certainly don't think that view is hard nose at all. I think it's the reality, what they call it, the school of hard knocks. But I think it's just the reality really is that kids need to, like you say, need to fail. And you know, we've all failed at something in the past, and like you say, it's just an opportunity for success moving forward from that and from what you learn from it. So there we go.
It's a big lesson, and I see parents say, well, we just you know, we want to make this fun for our kids. And that I don't disagree with that. And I always tell them competition is fun. And
definitely.
And I get this question all the time, you know, would you like to do a race and just kind of, you know, lay back in the race? And I've done that. I've done a lot of promotional races and I've started at the end. And then I've done other races when the gun goes off. And, you know, deep down inside, I said, well, I just want to see how hard I can go on this race. You know, and I don't want to tell everyone they're doing great and that's awesome while I'm racing. I just want to blow by them. And and I, you know, I tell parents this. I said, competition, this is the great candy of life. You know, you teach your kids how to be competitive. And you teach them how to lose. You teach them how to win and to compete. And when I see kids break down because they've lost the game, you know, you come back to them, you bring them up a little bit and say, okay, you lost, what can you do better? And I always tell my athletes, even the very best ones now, and they say, well, I had a terrible triathlon. You know, I did everything right. It was the worst day of my life. And my first question, and it's always been my first question, is I want you to give me a short list of what you did well. And they're so befuddled by that. What did I do well? No, I just told you I had a bad race. And I said, okay, let's break this down. How was the night before? Because you're setting yourself up. How about the morning? How was your meal? How did you feel in your warm up? And they start breaking it down. I said, well, I felt okay here. I felt okay there. And I said, okay, we've got 5 points that you did well. And I think it's a good way for people to learn, adults and children. There's always success in the greatest moments of failure.
Yeah, absolutely. Adam, any thoughts and points on that to sort of finish off there?
I don't think I can add anything, to be honest. It's a fantastic way of looking at things. And I'm not a parent myself, so I don't have any direct experience on that. But coaching athletes, yeah, absolutely. You've got to take the positives from everything, haven't we, and move forward. It's all part of the psychology of life, very much so.
The learning curve, exactly right. Well, Dave, thanks so much for your time, mate. It's been an absolute pleasure and privilege speaking to you today, sir. So, what have you got lined up for the rest of the day?
Well, it's early in the morning here. And as I said, the weather's nice. We had about 6 to 7 centimeters of snow. So there's snow on my roof. There's snow on the roadway. But in Boulder, it's real dry here after it snows. So there, on the main arteries, that'll be dry. So I'm actually going to go out for a bike ride. And I coach my swim squad in about 3 hours. So I'll be on the deck again and still a passion that both of you have. And people say, would you still like to coach? And I said, you know, I've been teaching for a long time and I still thoroughly enjoy it. But thanks for your time, you guys. And let's stay connected. So it's been 6 years, Paul.
Yes, I know. I was actually working that out myself. It has been that length of time, and I still have very fond memories about those sessions that we did at over there in Boulder, the swimming sessions. If anyone's listening to this and they happen to be passing Boulder and want to try and jump in with Dave, you will not regret those sessions. They are fantastic. I love the way you construct them, bring them together, and you know I'm quite pedantic, obviously being a coach as well, sort of thing about, I do most of my swimming by myself, but being involved in those sessions, you made me feel very, very welcome, Dave. And it was great swimming with some of the fantastic athletes that you had down there at the time as well. So yeah, thanks very much, Dave. It's been great.
Well, I'll just add one thing. I have a Dave Scott Tri Club. It's a membership program. I know that we're offering a discount to anyone who's listening to the podcast. And I think it's swim-smooth. It's a 10% discount. We have an annual thing. We have a lot of, I think maybe the best thing is we have a lot of great deals. We mentioned Scott Bike and Finesse and Hoka. They're all involved, but my thing is about providing content. So all the stuff that we talked about today, it's kind of an ongoing feeder system for me to talk about all the nuances of the sport. So you can go to my website, or just Google Dave Scott. You either get an astronaut or myself. And you can find it. There's a lot of Dave Scott. There's actually an entertainer and a felon too, I think, on Google.
Right? Really?
I'm neither one of those. So anyway, pleasure, you guys. Thanks for your time.
Well, another great interview there, this time obviously with Dave Scott. Dave giving up his time there to speak to us. What did you particularly enjoy about the show there, Adam? And anything left pondering?
Yeah, a few things. First up, I just want to say what a fantastic guy he is. I think he's one of my favourite people. I don't pretend to know him very well, but we've met him a few times. What a fantastic guy he is. And just a quick throwback story from when we were in Boulder. I probably should have told this during the recording, during the interview, is that somehow he got my phone number when we were in Boulder. Do you remember this? Now, back in the 90s when I was trading and racing, we used to idolize Dave Scott. He was like, you know, well, he was this sort of mythical figure, and what would Dave do, and what would, you know, when we were ever struggling with anything, we sort of idolized him. And when we were in Boulder, like 15 years later, he somehow got my phone number and he started ringing me up. And he goes, "Hey, Adam, would you?" And he got me like doing things. "Would you come down to the pool and help me with this?" And I was just like, "Yeah, Dave, no problem at all. Wow, you know, I can't believe it." And I was texting my old friends back home saying, "Dave Scott has just phoned me up. I can't believe it." So, yeah, what a lovely guy. Yeah. I think
he has an absolute genuine interest in you.
Well, yeah, I mean, we talked. I've had a history of a couple of illnesses, and I remember when he was over in London for the triathlon show, he put a lot of time. He gave me a lot of his time talking about that and the background. Such a nice guy. I can't really believe it. You know how nice he is and how interested he is in everyone. Yeah, and just throwing back to the interview, then I think the thing for me is it was interesting, wasn't it, when we're talking about how mentally. You know, when you've won a few times and there's an expectation from the media, and you sort of threw me the question and said, "Have you ever had any experiences like this, Adam?" And, you know, I said, "Well, experience helps and everything else." And Dave kind of disagreed with me, and which was interesting, and was saying that actually the more experienced you become as an athlete and the more successful you are, the harder it becomes because the expectation and the pressure become higher and higher. Now, of course, I personally was never an elite athlete. I don't have that personal perspective on it like Dave. So it's fascinating to get into that. And we heard a little bit of that from Simon Lessing, didn't we, a week or so ago. He was saying exactly the same thing, that there's this expectation that comes and support. And, you know, Dave as well, he was the pioneer, right? There was nobody who came before him. No, he was the first super successful triathlete, certainly over the Ironman distance. And, you know, there was no one to mentor him, no one to support him, to give him that backup, and perhaps no one even to take the flak. So, you know, when the media are phoning up and asking the questions, you know, if he'd have had a coach or he'd have had someone who, you know, was supporting him like that, they could have even stepped in and pushed back and said, "Hey guys, Dave's staying, he's training, I'm going to push that away." So some of the athletes these days, you know, they have that advantage. People have trodden the path before, you know, the you know, the rules on when you can interview an athlete and when you can interrupt them are laid down now. And in those days, Dave didn't have any of that. So
triathlon coaching wasn't even a profession, was it? You know, I mean, he sort of flipped off when I said to him, you know, did you have any training partners? And he said, not only don't not really have any training partners, didn't have a coach. And then he said, well, because obviously that was sort of my profession, you know, as a physical trainer and just an interest in a range of different sports, he felt he could coach himself. And why wouldn't you, when really there is no such thing at that point in time as a triathlon coach? And as I mentioned now, if you do a Google search, it returns 110 million returns for the word triathlon. And I think if you put in triathlon coaching, it'd certainly be well up there. Every man and his dog seems to be taking an interest in coaching and helping other people, and rightly so, of course. But back in those days, Dave didn't have that. And, you know, I even reflect a little bit about that myself, because we obviously, our first podcast guest who we keep going and referring back to is very good friend Daniel Plews. Dan went 8:24, if you missed that first show, 8:24 at Kona this year, won the age group world record and set the world record there in Kona. And I got chatting afterwards with Dan, and one of my things that I'd like to do, you know, bucket list items, is I would like to finally nail an Ironman. I'm not talking about racing it, smashing it, breaking any world records or anything like that. I'd just like to complete an Ironman at some point. I don't know when, but at some point. And he said, "You know what, Paul, first thing you're going to need is a coach." And I immediately thought, okay, Dan, I'd like you to coach me, because obviously, you know, we go back, we share some history and stuff, and has obviously done very, very well with it.
Yeah.
But what I mentioned there in the podcast with Dave is that when we traveled through Boulder, I mentioned very briefly that I am quite pedantic as a coach, because you get, as a coach, there's definitely an ego. There has to be some sort of ego and belief system in what you're doing. So, you know, Dan is going to be coaching differently to how I would be coaching. How do I feel about that? Will I trust it? Will I trust the system? Will I trust what he's actually set up for me? And I think a bigger thing really than the fact that we'd be coaching differently is this level of accountability. Somebody writing you a program that you have to complete, you have to report back, you send your file, whether it's a Power Meter file or whatever it might be, you send it back to that coach, and then they prepare the next block, the next training block based on that for you. And Dan got stuck into me sort of saying that, you know, if you don't have somebody to bounce those ideas off, you almost get into this stagnation of just doing what you enjoy doing. And if I reflect back to 2018, when I was training for the swim run events, etc., I definitely found myself, Adam, in that mode. I thought, right, I've got this routine each week. These sessions seem to be good. I quite enjoy doing them. And I was basically doing them each week just to try to get a little bit better at them. And there's nothing wrong with that. Maybe looking at doing it more efficiently, lower heart rate, faster time, whatever it might be, etc. But you definitely get caught in this sort of routine of just doing it for the sake of doing it, the sake of ease. And I think, you know, if I had a coach myself, then that would definitely be something to bounce those ideas off. And also to hopefully pick you up if you're feeling a bit down, you haven't been achieving well, or like I am now, I'm injured at the moment. How would somebody help you through that point? So, yeah, Dave, it was an interesting one because, like you say, he was the pioneer of the sport. He wanted to coach himself. He believed in that. Whether things would have turned out any differently, you know, 6 wins in Kona is not a bad record. And, you know, so whether or not...
Well, exactly, yeah. That's how you introduced it. You said that you seemed, you know, infallible, this sort of perfect being winning all these races. You know, even the great Mark Allen couldn't beat you for years and years and years. So, but the truth was a little bit different on the inside, which was, you know, absolutely fascinating, wasn't it? Yeah.
Very candid. And obviously we have to thank Dave for being as open and as honest as he was there on that respect. So, yeah, there we go. I thought it was a great chat. I loved it. And I think you mentioned there about Dave being a really nice guy and you feel like this genuine connection with him. And I feel that as well. And I think it's a true measure of somebody's integrity and character when you remember detail and have an interest in somebody else. So, you know, Dave remembered straight away, it's been 6 years since we hooked up. You know, he knew where we were when we hooked up. And, we're just two blokes trying to run a swim coaching program. You know, we're not Dave Scott. We're not up on this pedestal, et cetera. But Dave remembers that about us. He was including both of us in the conversation. And not a lot of people do that, you know. Just because you might be blessed with these amazing physical attributes that allow you to be a brilliant athlete, it doesn't necessarily make you a great person. But in Dave's case, you know, he is. And that's why I like sharing time with him. And to have that time with him today on the podcast was wonderful, really. And I really hope, listeners, that all shone through for you. So, there we go. Anything to add to that, Adam? Or?
No, not really. What a really great guy. And wish him all the best. I hope we can tie up with him again in the future soon. Yeah,
definitely. I think we've both got a little bit of man love for you there, Dave. So thanks for inspiring us, sir. And we wish
he's not a bad looking guy
going forwards. And he's not a bad looking guy. No, I think at 65 years of age, I'd want to be looking that good for sure. Yeah. He's 25 years older than me and he's in much better physical shape than I am. But there we go. So anyway, listeners, thanks very much for listening. We're probably going to take a short breather. We've pumped out 3 rapid fire podcasts there. We're going to get some new guests up on the horizon probably in the next week or two. So stay tuned and please do send us some feedback through. Get onto iTunes. Give us a rating on there, whatever it might be. Hopefully good. We're loving doing the shows. We're loving putting it out there for you, getting some great guests on. And equally, shoot us through an email as well. If you've got anybody you particularly want to hear from, they want to get on the show, etc., we'll do our very best to try to get them on the show. But thanks for listening. And here's to next time.